Welcome. My name is Katarzyna Monika Pawlak. I'm the social media trainee editor of UWiDzi Journal, and you're listening to UWiDzi Journal podcast. Each episode will highlight one of the most relevant articles recently published in the journal in order to learn from the most up-to-date evidence and discuss with the authors the relevant findings of their research.
Welcome to the UWiDzi Journal podcast on the paper Unraveling the Relationship Between Autoimmune Pancreatitis Type 2 and Inflammatory Bowel Disease, results from two centers and systematic review of the literature which is currently in press in the journal. My name is Yago Rodriguez. I am a trainee editor of the UWiDzi Journal and gastroenterologist in Bilbao, Spain. And I'm glad to welcome Dr. Biha Sinovic from the Department of Upper Abdominal Disease at the Karolinska University Hospital in Stockholm, who will join me today for this interview. Welcome, Dr. Biha Sinovic. It is a great pleasure to have you here today, and congratulations for this great paper. Dr. Biha Sinovic has worked here with more colleagues from Slovenia, Serbia, and Italy. So could you please introduce yourself and your research team?
Hi, and first of all, thank you very much for invitation in this podcast. My name is Miroslav Jasinovic, and I work as a gastroenterologist at the Karolinska University Hospital in Stockholm, Sweden. And this paper was performed together with our colleagues from Italy, from San Raffaele Center in Milano. And it included a multidisciplinary approach because autoimmune pancreatitis is a complex disease. And this was the reason why we included a bigger team. Of course, this is also a rare disease, an orphan disease. And we noticed that the number of the patients in our center is too small. And this was the reason why we decided to make this as a B-centric study and additionally to perform a systematic review on the topic.
Thank you. I think that most of us are aware of the relationship between both diseases, but I think that you found that there are still an unmet need and research gaps here because there are probably not enough patients described up to now.
Yes, we think, I mean, I work as a pancreatologist and endoscopist. These are the main area of my work. And together with my colleagues on high specialized pancreatology unit, we function basically as a tertiary center for the Sweden. We noticed that it is really difficult to diagnose the autoimmune pancreatitis. And we noticed some characteristics of this patient, especially association with the inflammatory bowel disease that are really important. And just for your listeners, I think I would like just to shortly emphasize the relatively short history of autoimmune pancreatitis in general. So we talk about a relatively new entity. Interestingly, the first case report was published in 1961, but from some reasons, it was complete academic silence up to mid-90s when the Japanese colleagues coined the name and proposed the concept of the autoimmune pancreatitis. But then there were some case reports and short case series. And in 2011, international criteria, the consensus diagnostic criteria were published, and we are still using this criteria. And since 2011, we differentiate subtypes of autoimmune pancreatitis. So most of our patients has autoimmune pancreatitis type 1, and it is related to, it is a part of IgG4 related disease. Minority of patients are autoimmune pancreatitis type 2, and this type has nothing to do with the IgG4. This is a special entity that is mostly associated with the inflammatory bowel disease. And there is another similarity between these two diseases. As we know, in IBD, there is ulcerosis and Crohn's disease, and a small part of the indeterminate cases. Is also an autoimmune pancreatitis. Sometimes we cannot decide if it is type 1 or type 2. So there is a small group of patients called autoimmune pancreatitis, not other specified. So the number of patients is low. And we noticed from our clinical experience that the patients with type 2 autoimmune pancreatitis have some specific characteristics. And this was the reason why we perform this study. In general, they have a mild course and better prognosis compared to the autoimmune pancreatitis type 1. The relapse is not so common, but once when we have this patient, it is not easy to diagnose and to follow up. So this was the main reason why we decided to do the study.
Perfect. Thank you, because those details provide a great perspective of this topic. And if I am correct, you initially performed a retrospective study in two referral European centers. So can you explain us your main findings of this part of your work?
Yes. So in total, there were 35 patients, and it's 24 patients from Stockholm and 11 patients from San Raffaele. And as just we expected, most of the patients, it's 83% of the patients have inflammatory bowel disease. Our first aim was to see if there is any difference in the term of outcome of the disease. That means if the patients with IBD have some differences compared to the patients without IBD, and we didn't find any difference. But what we found is that the treatment of these patients was very successful. That means all patients at the time of the analysis were in a clinical remission. And almost all patients, I think 93%, are in a radiological remission. So I would also like to explain this difference. So when we objectivize the results of the treatment, of course, the first is to see how the patient feels, if it's asymptomatic or symptomatic. And secondly, we always perform control with the magnetic resonance imaging. So we had two patients in whom there were signs of mild inflammation ongoing in the pancreas, but they have no clinical symptoms, and the laboratory was normal. So this is why we always emphasize difference between clinical and radiological remission. And we were, of course, very happy because, as you know, in pancreatology, there are a lot of diseases that we cannot treat, or we are not very good in the treatment, but this is a disease where we can treat the etiology, and the cornerstone of the treatment is the same in both diseases. It's a glucocorticoids, and when we analyzed the treatment, we noticed that it is not just glucocorticoids. I mean, patients with inflammatory bowel disease are mostly nowadays controlled with the biological treatment. And this was very interesting for us because biological treatment is not included in the guidelines for the treatment for autoimmune pancreatitis, but it is logical to expect that biological treatments will also have benefit for the autoimmune pancreatitis. So basically, we talk about the same group of drugs that we use for the treatment of the disease that have autoimmune etiology. And this has two important conclusions. First, of course, it can be that the high percent of clinical remission is due to the biologics, of course, as a maintenance treatment. But also, vice versa, we think that it can be a reason for underdiagnosed pancreas disease in this group of patients, because if the patient has no clinical symptoms of pancreatitis, this is very good, but still there can be consequences that are clinically important. So the results were very interesting and important for us from the clinical point of view, and definitely it will improve our workup of the patients.
Thank you. And as your study is followed by a systematic review, can we obtain some conclusions about the diagnosis or the increased awareness among IBDologists or general practitioners or gastroenterologists? I mean, should we screen for this condition, or how we can identify early these changes in the pancreas?
So autoimmune pancreatitis is a disease that is not easy to diagnose, and all guidelines first, HISOR guidelines from 2006 and ICDC from 2011 emphasize different diagnostic criteria. We can explain it very easily with the first guidelines. They called HISORT, and this is basically acronym. It's H, that stands from histology, I from imaging, S from serology, O is for other organ involvement, and RT is the response to treatment. So this is not a disease where we can perform just one procedure and said, okay, this is the diagnosis. So we must put this in a much, much broader context. Unfortunately, in type 2 autoimmune pancreatitis, we have no serology. So in type 1, we can use IgG4, but here we still have no something that we can measure in the blood. Other organ involvement in the term of IBD is so common that it was incorporated in the diagnostical criteria. So if we have suspected autoimmune pancreatitis on basis of imaging in a patient with IBD, that immediately increased the possibility of diagnosis of autoimmune pancreatitis. So it's a very good question how to diagnose. So what we learned from our results and from the systematic review is that approximately half of the patients presented with acute pancreatitis. So I think this is the first step where we can identify at least some of these patients. Of course, when we meet patients with acute pancreatitis, autoimmune etiology is not the first one that people think about. Most patients have alcoholic etiology or biliary etiology. But once when we exclude other etiologies, that means alcohol, biliary, drug induced, or hypertriglyceridemia, then we should think about autoimmune etiology. So if we have a patient with IBD and acute pancreatitis without obvious etiology, we absolutely must continue in a workup to confirm or exclude autoimmune etiology. Another problem that can happen in these patients is azathioprine induced acute pancreatitis, because azathioprine is, of course, a second line of the treatment. And we know that approximately 7% of patients can have drug induced pancreatitis due to the azathioprine. Yes, it can be due to the azathioprine, but it can be also autoimmune pancreatitis that was misdiagnosed as azathioprine induced. So, when we start to talk about these things, there are new and new questions and problems appearing here. And when we check out retrospectively how we come to the diagnosis, it is also noticed quite a high percentage of the patients who had basically incidental findings. So it may sound weird, so I would like to explain how that happened. So as we know, imaging of patients in general is increasing. Computed tomography and magnetic resonance imaging is a standard everywhere today in Europe. And patients are coming from our IBD. So, of course, in a secondary level of treatment, gastroenterologists follow all patients, but in subspecialized tertiary clinics, we are separated into small groups. And most of our patients come from the IBD group because the IBD experts had some dilemmas in these patients. So they were satisfied with the IBD treatment. Cal protective levels were satisfied. The colonoscopy showed very nice mucosa healing. And their patients still had problems in the term of bloating, soft stools, sometimes diarrhea, weight loss, even in the laboratory markers, they noticed malnutrition. And then they performed computed tomography or magnetic resonance imaging, and experienced radiologists immediately noticed atrophy of the pancreas or some focal lesions or a generally swallowed gland. And this is how they come to us. And this is important, basically, to emphasize. This is a teamwork. This patient's must be followed only as a multidisciplinary approach, and radiologists must be included and there, and always check how the pancreas looks like. Also, surgeons who are meeting quite often patients with acute pancreatitis and some focal lesions in pancreas must be aware of this. And the most important is, of course, in these patients to exclude pancreatic cancer. Because some patients can present with focal lesion in pancreas, and first of all, we must exclude cancer. And this is why when we start with the treatment, another control is after the 3 or maximum 4 weeks. Because if it is autoimmune pancreatitis, we expect dramatic response on steroids. it is just a matter question if it is complete or partial regress, but we expect regress. And of course, it is a great mimicker, and sometimes we can be surprised. So first of all, exclude pancreatic cancer, and secondly, confirm autoimmune pancreatitis. And this is how we treat these patients. So we came at the end of the workup, we clarified the compliance. So they had problems because of the pancreatic exocrine insufficiency caused by the autoimmune pancreatitis, and it has nothing to do with the IBD itself. And when we found first patients, then we had now much better cooperation with all gastroenterologists and surgeons and radiologists, and they immediately inform us of these patients. So this is what I could also recommend to the other colleagues in other centers. So the awareness is very important. Think about extra intestinal involvement in patients with IBD, and think about autoimmune pancreatitis. This is what is the most important message.
Great, thank you. That's very clear, and it seems very relevant for us as gastroenterologists who are managing this kind of patients. And following your explanation about this initial presentation, I would like to ask you about the long-term prognosis or the management. How do you follow these patients? How do you follow them with the imaging or with any other lab test in your center or according to your study? How should we doing this in the following years?
Yeah, this is a very important question. Thank you for that. We recently published in UEG Journal also European guidelines of IgG4 digestive diseases. So this is not type 2, this is type 1, but the problem with autoimmune pancreatitis, type 1 and 2 are the same. So the most important is the risk of cancer. So there are studies showing that it might be increased risk of pancreatic cancer in patients with autoimmune pancreatitis. We still don't have a lot of evidences because we talk about rare disease, but the recently published systematic review showed 33 cases of pancreatic cancer. Fortunately, in these patients that we include in the present paper, nobody developed pancreatic cancer, neither colorectal cancer, in follow-up was approximately 5 years. But it does not exclude risk, of course. So this is why we follow them on a yearly basis. And we absolutely follow them with a clinical laboratory, but also magnetic resonance imaging. This is that's something that we use routinely every year. Once when we exclude the cancer, of course, it's much easier to follow them. And as all patients with chronic pancreatitis, also these patients without immune pancreatitis have high risk of development pancreatic exocrine insufficiency and diabetes mellitus. And of course, most of the patients are treated with the glucocorticoids, so this even increases the risk of diabetes mellitus. And all studies performed on this topic, including a very nice systematic review that recently published our colleagues from San Raffaele, the co-authors here, showed that the prevalence of pancreatic exocrine insufficiency and diabetes mellitus is very high. Almost half of the patients will develop one or both. And when we talk about exocrine insufficiency, it seems that it's just a matter of time, and it's not related to the treatment. We treat these patients with steroids, even some of them with rituximab, but no, despite of the treatment, exocrine insufficiency will appear. So if the patient has normal exocrine and endocrine function at the diagnosis, the first control is after 6 months, and after that we follow on a yearly basis. And it is important to emphasize that pancreatic exocrine insufficiency can be treated very easily with the pancreatic enzyme replacement treatment. And all these patients with weight loss and bloating and soft stools can have normal quality of life. So our aim, and we succeeded in most of the patients, I mean, if the compliance of the patient is good, we are very successful with the treatment. And we have three aims. First aim, that the patient has normal stool habits. Second aim is that we maintain weight, that there is a weight gain or stable weight. And thirdly, that laboratory serum nutritional panel is normal, because in these patients, we didn't discuss this in the paper, but the serum nutritional panel is important, because in the patients with pancreatic exocrine insufficiency, fat soluble vitamins and trace elements deficiency is quite common. And in IBD, of course, it can be problems with the iron and other types of deficiencies. So our follow-up include magnetic resonance imaging. Secondly, fetal elastase for the exocrine insufficiency, glycated hemoglobin for diabetes mellitus, and fat-soluble vitamins and trace elements of zinc, magnesium, and calcium as a routine follow-up. So this is how approximately we can manage these patients. And I must say that we are very satisfied with the results, because if we recognize the disease at the right time, if we start with the treatment appropriately, then we can really be satisfied with the results, just as this study showed.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Vuhasinovic, for joining us today, and congratulations for this paper. And once again, we hope to see you again and more results from your research on autoimmune pancreatitis.
Thank you very much. So I would just like to thank you and the whole team for inviting us to this podcast. It's a great pleasure, and it's a great opportunity to show the results of our study. And I would like to congratulate the whole team for the idea of starting the podcast, because this is an excellent way how we can create awareness and emphasize the most important results and to reach even broader audience and listeners for this. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and I wish you good luck with your future work on the podcast.
Thank you. And to our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this interview, and I invite you to read the full version of this paper. And as always, please come and join us again for future UG Journal podcasts. Thank you.
We hope that you enjoyed this interview, and please subscribe for further updates. Thank you, and see you again.